February 1, 1995. So if she's taking notes, you all just leave her be. Justice Doggett is not here today, but he may participate in the decisions of these cases if they are announced before the expiration of his term. We have five causes consolidated into four arguments on our oral submission docket this morning. And in the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Ernesto Gonzalez versus Jesus R. Avalos Sr. from El Paso County. The City of Brownsville versus Eugenio Alvarado and Olga Alvarado from Cameron County. Parita Sines and Felipe Sines Jr. versus Fidelity and Guarantee Insurance Underwriters and Gisela Armstrong from Hidalgo County. And James M. Duncan versus the Board of Disciplinary Appeals and Oral Mandamus Proceeding Consolidated Oral Argument with the matter of James M. Duncan, an original disciplinary appeal. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners or relator may reserve a portion of their 20 minutes for rebuttal by so advising the marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will complete these arguments before our lunch break. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of an argument, you may make application with our clerk. Court is ready to hear from petitioner in Gonzalez versus Avalos.
May it please the court. My name is Edwin M. Smith. I'm an assistant attorney general. I represent Ernesto Gonzalez, the petitioner in this matter. Mr. Gonzalez was sued in his individual capacity for negligence in performing of certain duties as an employee of the Department of Human Services. Today, this court is presented with an opportunity to define the doctrine of official immunity for government workers in the social welfare and child welfare sectors of government. It can define the tests that were articulated in City of Lancaster v. Chambers for police officers, and the test that was recently announced in Kasson for medical professionals as to how they will apply for the particular circumstances that affect child welfare workers on a daily basis. In particular, I believe this case presents an important issue of whether or not state employees are going to be held personally liable for good faith efforts in following guidelines and procedures established by their agencies. In this particular case, a big portion of the opinion from the Court of Appeals takes the position that Mr. Gonzalez breached a ministerial duty in failing to order an investigation of a referral of child abuse. The summary judgment evidence particularly outlines how Mr. Gonzalez followed guidelines that were presented to him in the CPS Child Protective Services Handbook, that those guidelines gave him particular reasons and rationales for reviewing the facts in a child abuse referral, and how he applied those factors, determined that an allegation of abuse which required investigation was not made, and to that end, close the file without ordering an investigation. The facts of this case are fairly simple. Mr. Avalos came in to Child Protective Services headquarters in El Paso on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving in 1988. He met with an intake worker. She met with him for about 30 minutes, listened to his statement, wrote into a referral form her transcription of what he had told her. Clearly, he was concerned about the welfare of his children, but the summary judgment evidence shows that he was unable to articulate factual circumstances which really rose to the level of abuse. This was confirmed by the intake worker in her later affidavit that he was unable to articulate factual matters that rose to the level of abuse. The intake referral form was forwarded to Mr. Gonzalez, who as a CPS supervisor was required to review the referral forms, make an evaluation based solely on the information contained in those forms and on his consultation with Ms. Caldera, who was the...
Well, you're saying it's undisputed in the evidence that Avalos was able to communicate that his 5-year-old son had marks about his neck.
That's correct.
That he was terrified of this man, and that his dad had been beaten up by this man. Is that the sum total of the knowledge?
Yes, he articulated that he had seen marks on his son's neck almost a month earlier, which he had not reported those immediately. His father concluded that, his statement is that his father concludes that he is terrified of his son because his son won't tell him. It's not that his son has told him that he's terrified of his father. His father's making that assumption. And yes, it is true that there was an altercation between the man who ultimately killed the other son of Mr. Avalos. But I think that is something that Mr. Gonzalez was able to consider in determining whether or not Mr. Avalos' complaints, which centered primarily upon visitation matters, constituted an allegation of abuse, or whether these were a retributory motion on his part to try and get DHS involved in what was essentially a custody dispute at that time. Mr. Gonzalez had 3.5 years as the Child Protective Services supervisor in analyzing these cases. This is not the only case that came across his desk that day. He reviewed many of them. He was obligated to make these decisions based on the information that he had in light of, as the rules dealing with assigning cases for priority say, considering many factors, including the severity of the alleged harm, the likelihood of its recurrence. This is the first instance of any report against the mother of the children or her boyfriend. And importantly, he was to consider the resources of DHS and able to address the problems that came towards him.
Under what circumstances would a child care worker be personally liable?
Well, I think that involves clearly the application of official immunity in the child care worker area. He has to be outside the scope of employment. He has to be performing a ministerial rather than a discretionary function. And he has to perform it in bad faith.
So you're arguing purely in the affirmative defense of official immunity. You're not arguing that there's no legal obligation to investigate every allegation of child abuse.
In 1988, there was no legal obligation to investigate every allegation of child abuse. I believe the law has been changed now to where a referral that implies abuse, there are now requirements that further inquiry has to be made, and there is an obligation to investigate every allegation of child abuse.
That there was an affirmative misstatement in this record, regardless of what you might think the causation is that fact enough to infer any evidence of malice?
An affirmative misstatement?
About contacting Mr. Avalos to say that there would be no further investigation or not.
Well, first, I think it's important to consider that the summary judgment evidence does not support that allegation by the respondent in this case. There is no indication in the record anywhere that Mr. Avalos was not contacted. That is not part of the summary judgment proof that's before this court or before any other court before it. In answer to your question, I don't think that's particularly an aspect or would necessarily take him out of the out of good faith. Under the question in good faith, as I understand it, the way the court has presented it now, is that were actions objectionably reasonable? And the actions are those related to his discretionary functions. Would he made a mistake in that regard, in that respect, it's possible. Was he negligent in that respect? I suppose it's possible. But those are the types of things that are not relevant to a discussion of good faith or official immunity. Official immunity protects employees from suit based on their negligence. We have, this court in Chambers quoted Swint v. City of Wadley for what the objective legal reasonableness means in the good faith context. And it talks about whether the conduct is lawful in the light of clearly established law and the information possessed by the official at the time the conduct occurred. Thus, qualified immunity protects all but the plainly incompetent or those who knowingly violate the law. The issue here is review the actions of Mr. Gonzalez and determine were his actions plainly incompetent. Does the summary judgment evidence support that? I don't believe it does. The summary judgment evidence goes on at great length to discuss the deliberative process he employed in reviewing the facts in the referral. It talks at length about how he applied the standards that he had learned in 3.5 years as a CPS supervisor, the standards that were provided him by his agency in the CPS handbook. There is no indication there that he was failing to perform his duties or that he was incompetent in his duties. He may have made an erroneous decision. In hindsight, we can all say that. We all, I'm sure, feel for Mr. Avalos' family and for Mr. Avalos at the loss of his son. But we have a situation, especially in child care welfare workers, that they're faced with these decisions every day. They're faced to make these decisions with limited resources. The issue really is, could a reasonably prudent supervisor under the same or similar circumstances have believed that either his determination that the allegation was one of non-abuse, in which case there was no investigatory requirement whatsoever, or his belief that he was not obligated to order an investigation pursuant to the guidelines that were provided him by the DHS handbook were proper.
Was there also an element of complaining about lack of, or the frustration of the complainant about visitation rights to his children?
According to Ms. Caldera, and in the report itself, there are specific references to that. He is complaining that he is unable to see his children. Let's not forget, this is the day before Thanksgiving. But the holidays routinely bring out people concerned about seeing their children over the holidays. Yes, it was specific about that. He also complained in general about not being able to see his children, about blaming his ex-wife's boyfriend as being responsible for preventing him from seeing his children. And as later stated by Ms. Caldera in her witness statement, he was unable to articulate truly meaningful, factual assertions that rose to the level of abuse. As Mr. Gonzalez points out, there had been no report from the schools, though Mr. Avalos claims he saw these marks on his son at school. Schools are obligated to provide or to report what they think are signs of abuse to the authorities. There was no evidence of that. There was no report of that.
Did Mr. Avalos complain or express concerns about threats to the safety of his two-year-old child that was ultimately killed?
No, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. There's no mention of that.
So the summary judgment evidence, you say, is confined strictly to his concerns about the five-year-old child at the basis of this complaint.
From the perspective of analyzing Mr. Gonzalez's actions, really, the summary judgment evidence is limited to the statements that are in the referral report and his affidavit discussing how he addressed those statements in the report. But even if you look at Mr. Avalos' later statement, there's that he expressed any direct concern about the two-year-old at all. There are some factual disputes about whether he told Ms. Caldera that the marks on the neck were scratches or bruises. But of course, Ms. Caldera said that Mr. Avalos told him that the marks occurred when his mother took off the child's Halloween costume. She also said that she told that to Mr. Gonzalez, that was part of what he was considering. What did these marks mean? Well, I have my intake worker interviewed the complainant saying they're the result of a Halloween costume. That's clearly not an allegation of abuse. The reason this court should reverse the Court of Appeal in the first place is because they have muddled and mixed the elements of discretionary function and scope of authority. And they do this, obviously, without the benefit of the opinion of this court in Chambers, which lays out the test for those two elements very clearly. Under the analysis adopted by this court in Chambers and reiterated in Kasten, I think it's fairly clear that from the evidence that Mr. Gonzalez was involved in personal deliberation, decision, and judgment, and that his decision was directly tied to allocation of a scarce pool of state resources among possible recipients. That meets discretionary function under Chambers. It meets the governmental function under Kasten. And as noted by this court just last week in Kasten, the good faith performance of government responsibilities should not be subject to second guessing in the courtroom. But in fact, what the Court of Appeals does is determine, as a matter of law, I suppose, that the report constitutes an allegation of abuse. And based on that assumption, goes on to the family code and says that Mr. Gonzalez had an obligation to order an investigation. The opinion of the Court of Appeals, first off, it does muddle the two elements and how they're addressed. It's not a question of whether he did a wrongful thing. It's whether Mr. Gonzalez was enabled to do a discretionary action and whether it was in the course and scope of his duties. The Court of Appeals then acknowledges that Gonzalez occupied a quasi-judicial position in their report, in their opinion, and that Avalos agreed that he was acting generally in the scope of his employment. That meets the discretionary and the scope of employment test. More importantly, the Court of Appeals has interjected itself in what may be a factual determination. Was this abuse, was this report an allegation of abuse? But it begs the question of whose responsibility it is to make that decision. That decision was allocated to Mr. Gonzalez as part of his job duties as a CPS supervisor. And whether it is a wrongful decision or whether we think it's an erroneous decision in hindsight is not the issue. If that is the type of decision that he was enabled to make, if he made that decision in good faith, which his affidavits and the summary judgment evidence show, he went through a deliberative process applying standards which were available to him, then he has performed that in good faith. And whether or not it's wrong, whether or not DHS may ultimately hold some responsibility to Mr. Avalos are not the questions. We're addressing an individual who works for the state here. We are trying to decide how much we will protect them when they perform duties on behalf of the state. That's the central policy issue behind the affirmative defense of official immunity. It is a trade-off.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas
D.
Smith, argument.
Thank you. Good morning. These are somewhat extreme facts for this court to make the determination that there was no legal duty in 1988 for Mr. Avalos, Mr. Gonzalez, to move forward and initiate the investigation. Respectfully, the affidavit, the statement that was taken down by Caldera really is a little stronger than was portrayed a few moments ago. In addition to the bruises on the neck, let me begin at the top. The statement begins, complainant...
Can I ask you something? The copy that was in the record is the handwritten copy. Anywhere in the record, is there a typewritten transcription of that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's set out properly in the text in a footnote in Mr. Smith's brief. Pardon me, I don't recall the name of the number of the footnote.
All right, but it's in Mr. Smith.
Yes. The major premise, though, of the statement is complainant alleges child abuse to his son. And then there are specific facts that were articulated to Ms. Caldera and put in the statement. And each of those facts at trial will be demonstrated to be hallmarks of child abuse. The first is the marks on the neck. We believe the evidence will be that they were bruises on the neck. The second, of course, is the fear. And I think that it is unambiguous in the record, and the trial court and the appellate court presume that the fear was directed to the stepfather in the home. Third is that there was weight loss. And we believe at trial the evidence will show that weight loss isn't related to a nutritional problem, but related more to the stress, and that's a hallmark of child abuse. When a child of that age experiences dramatic weight loss, the hallmark sign that people like Mr. Gonzalez are trained to identify as a specific element in support of child abuse. In addition to that, you had the declaration that there had been extreme violence in the home by the alleged perpetrator, that the complainant had personally experienced that level of violence. Finally, you had an allegation that there were drugs in the home and how that can create additional stressors and violence in a home.
Mr. Smith raises the issue of the Court of Appeals muddling the difference between scope and authority of Mr. Gonzalez's function and the discretionary nature of his function to make a decision. How do you respond to that? Are you saying that Mr. Gonzalez, under the facts as presented to him, he had merely a ministerial duty to order an investigation and therefore there was no decision to be made at this point, and on what authority do you assert that it was then ministerial?
or...
Your Honor, in 1988 and today, he had an absolute legal duty. It was a ministerial duty. An example of a place where it was discretionary, the court finding in Lancaster, is that there were not specific statutes that gave direction to the police officer in that matter. They were not specifically clear and directive whereby the police officer could have no question that he was under a legal duty to act. That evidence is not strong. In this case, the legislature had spoken quite specifically about the need to protect children. In 34.05 of the Texas Family Code, the language that the appellate court looked at, and I think language respectfully that is important to that determination of ministerial versus discretionary, is it begins with, when there is an allegation of abuse and neglect, the DPRS, Child Protective Services, shall. And then there's a list of steps that should be taken, decisions that may be made. And I think that the status of the law ought to be after this opinion, after this clarification, is that if any act is taken in the course of investigation, that act brings you within the discretionary function. However, to initiate that investigation is a ministerial act upon which there can be no ambiguity. Let's look at what the priority system was in 1988. I think counsel has correctly stated that it was amended later. And the current status is we have essentially priority 1 and 2, and there's no ambiguity about it. In 1988, in any event where there is an allegation of abuse and neglect, it was a priority 1 or priority 2. The difference between those two priorities that Mr. Gonzalez, the only discretion he could possibly have, didn't relate to the question of instigating an investigation, because the threshold question was there an allegation of abuse or neglect? The only other issue that he can make a determination on is whether it is should be prioritized for any immediate investigation or there's an extended time period because of the danger of immediate abuse and harm. Whether this was a priority 1 or 2 is a matter that would be within his discretionary function.
You do concede that caseworker would have to decide whether or not it was an allegation of abuse in order to fall into either priority.
Respectfully, no. I can't concede
that. So anytime anybody walks into Child Protective Services and talks to an intake worker, it is an allegation of abuse.
No, Your Honor, I think put in those terms, I would need to make that concession that not any time. But
if
where
you
there
use
are
the word abuse, it's an allegation of abuse. I mean, where do you make the cutoff? And you say there was no discretion in this case to decide that this was not an allegation of abuse. And maybe you think this case is clear, but surely you would concede there's some cases not clear.
The legislature seems to indicate in the importance and the requirement of any person who has knowledge of abuse to report it, that there's a higher standard of protection or requirement of protection. And I think that the case can be made, Your Honor, that if someone brings themselves to the person to whom a report should be made, that is, brings themselves to the office, and they've identified, it's not an anonymous one, and they identify who they are, and they use that magic word, there is a child who is in danger of abuse, that raises the ministerial duty to go further.
Now, if the department at some much higher level than where the defendant is working has published internal guidelines, whether because they just can't read the statute or whether the statute is impractical, sometimes the legislature says, do something, it's going to take $1 million to do, and they appropriate $10,000 to do it. It has happened.
Sure, sure.
If the department has promulgated guidelines that may be at variance with your reading of the statute, what effect does that have on the individual liability of this employee?
Let me add one additional part to that hypothetical, Your Honor. If this court determines that it's a ministerial act to investigate child abuse, then the issue of his good faith reliance on that statute, as in the Anderson versus Creighton federal opinion. However, if this court determines that it is a discretionary act, then it would be relevant as to whether or not any caseworker could reasonably rely, or in good faith, could rely on have a mistaken belief in how the law works. That was the extension that the federal courts, the U.S. Supreme Court made in Anderson versus Creighton, extending the Harlow versus Fitzgerald test. It appears to me that in Texas we are heading with Lancaster to the kind of analysis that in the event that there is a ministerial, it's a ministerial function, that there is an objective component, an objective basis for the way courts should analyze the good faith issue.
Statutory language that existed in 1988 is not the same language that exists in regard to conducting investigations now, is it?
Your Honor, I could be in error. I believe it is the one that we're looking at, 1988, has that mandatory shall language in it. If there's another distinction the court's looking at, I will look at it and supplement with a letter. I believe the relevant statute has not changed.
No amendment to the investigative requirement?
Yes, sir. I need to qualify that, though. I will look at that issue and respond. If this court makes a determination that it's a ministerial function, respectfully, the analysis should end there.
Counsel, is there any claim in this lawsuit based on behalf of the 5-year-old?
There's not, Your Honor.
So the claim is made on behalf then only of the 2-year-old child who was subsequently killed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I believe does that make any difference that the complaint, that the report to the Child Protection Services related to another child other than the one that was ultimately killed?
It doesn't at this stage, in my view, Your Honor, because we're at summary judgment stage on the personal immunity. I think at trial, it may be a hotly contested issue on foreseeability, causation issues. I believe that the expert, that's amenable to expert testimony. What happens, in fact, at that time, when there's an investigation commenced, there's an audit or an inventory taken of the status of all children in the home. And that's part of 34.05. It's one of the things that must be done during the course of an investigation is determine the ages and the status of the other children in the home. Part of the tragedy of this case is that at trial the evidence will show that there were bruises on the neck of the 5-year-old and the 2-year-old was hung by a chain from his neck in the last incident that caused his death.
So you claim that a report of abuse to the 5-year-old should have precipitated, had invoked a ministerial obligation on the part of Child Protective Services to conduct an investigation not only of the allegations of abuse related to that child, but also to see if other children in the home had been abused or were in any danger.
Yes, sir. And I think at trial there may be some defenses relevant to that, but at this stage procedurally, I believe that that is not an important distinction for the purposes of the issues before this court. If there are no other questions, I think I'd like to...
Regards good faith, should we get to that issue, do you agree that the City of Lancaster against Chambers standard applies in this case?
I do and would hope that if the court were to determine this as a discretionary matter and get to the good faith analysis, I think that it would be helpful to us in the trial court level if this court were to clarify this application of Lancaster v. Chambers. That is a reasonably prudent person under those circumstances. And I believe, respectfully, it's a close question. That is, where there is a false entry made on the document, and the false entry is of a material matter directly related to the legal obligation, that is going to weigh on the issue of good faith. Whether it blocks it as a matter of law, I'm not sure, but I think certainly for the fact finder at the trial and the appellate court level, they're going to want to take a look at that issue.
The test in Chambers is whether a reasonably prudent officer, this was in the chase context, could have believed that his actions were necessary. The could have believed is a fairly high standard, and you say you agree that it should apply in a case like this.
If this employee
could have believed that there was no basis for investigation, then that's sufficient for immunity.
Yes, Your Honor. And because the development the recent development by this court in the area, I think procedurally, one way of handling this case would be remanding it to the trial court for specific findings. on those issues once this court makes a determination, if it intends to, whether this is a ministerial or discretionary act.
Just as a follow-up, are you contending there should be any different test for official immunity in this context than what we adopted in the police chase context in City of Lancaster versus...
I don't, Your Honor, apart from tailoring the language, and let me say briefly where that comes from. Respectfully, I do have experience in federal court representing individual public employees sued in their individual capacity, and there really is a whole threshold of cases that don't meet any standard of, they're just not meritorious at all. And I think the federal courts have worked out a good system for allowing only those few meritorious cases where there's clear bad faith into the courts. And I think the interlocutory appeal is one good way of handling that in the event that the trial court makes a bad decision. I do feel, respectfully, that this court's moving in the right direction with the Lancaster and the Casson opinions on that, especially Lancaster v. Chambers.
So your position in this case would have to be that no reasonable person in the government employee's position would have decided not to investigate this case?
That's right, Your Honor. Of course, that's the second position. The first position is that it was not a matter amenable to discretion at all, to the ministerial act. And the second is that the trial court, the appellate court, read these facts in a way that really has decided that issue for us. Or at least they should begin another crack at making that specific finding of good faith based on the changes in the law. Thank you, unless there's any other question.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
First, Judge Spector, page 27, note 6. A couple of things, I think, have come out in the respondent's address to the court today. First, he's still trying to try this case on facts which aren't in evidence before this court. We're not in evidence at the summary judgment level for the trial court. We're not in evidence before the Court of Appeals. The record is limited to the summary judgment evidence, which is before you, as it was before the evidence. Anything else that's brought up, I think, is irrelevant and must be ignored. He makes it, I think, an important concession, and then he says that it is a closed question whether it was reasonable for, under these circumstances, for somebody not to order an investigation. It is these closed questions that we are trying to protect individual state employees from liability for making. As I understand the test in Chambers, it has to be no question at all. That it must be absolutely that nobody could have believed that what Mr. Gonzalez did was appropriate under the circumstances before good faith was defeated. As to the discretionary matters that have been addressed...
You're saying the standard should be should and not could. You're saying the standard under Chambers should be should, not could.
No, I think the standard under Chambers is appropriately restricted to if the state employee can present evidence that he made his decision in good, based on the facts that were available to him, and that somebody else could have come to the same conclusion, then he's entitled to good faith, whether or not somebody else could determine that that they disagree with him. I mean, that's what we're protecting these employees from, is from disagreements with other people. As long as it's objectively reasonable that he came to the decision that he did, then he's entitled to good faith. Now, I think an interesting aspect under Chambers, and this court has leaned towards the federal standard, but has rejected the inquiry as to whether or not the actions of the employee were lawful or not, or whether they violated clearly articulated constitutional or statutory rights. It's not being an element that's really going to be addressed in this situation. That is not going to be a threshold question. I think under earlier cases, ones that are cited in Torres v. Owens, there has been an issue whether or not the state employee's actions were lawful or unlawful. But they went on to point out that unlawful does not take an employee out of official immunity as long as they're performing their functions in good faith and performing discretionary governmental functions. But I'd like to address, there's a lot of emphasis here on the Family Code, Section 3405, and the mandatory discretionary aspects of it. Are they ministerial? Are they not? If you look at Section 3405, it does give some guidelines on how to conduct an investigation once an allegation of abuse is referred to investigation. The impact of those guidelines has been addressed by courts already in this state, and Austin v. Hale and Eagle versus Texas Department of Human Services. I think we're back to the same situation in there where if it's a reasonably good faith belief that they conducted a good investigation, that they're entitled to immunity. None of that addresses whether or not an allegation of abuse is made triggering an investigation and who makes that determination. That's really what I think this case is about. Who was entitled to make the determination in the field based on the facts available at the time that this referral is an allegation of abuse? If it is not an allegation of abuse, or if it's determined not to be an allegation of abuse, right or wrong, there is no triggering mechanism requiring an investigation. Perhaps if he had decided it was an allegation of abuse, still didn't order it for an investigation, it would be a much closer call, I think. Then we'd be talking about should he have ordered a priority one or a priority two. But that's not the circumstance in this case. The real issue is, are we going to second guess Mr. Gonzalez's determination that the facts presented to him do not constitute an allegation of abuse? I submit this court has said we will not do that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause, and the court will now take a brief recess.